Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The history that occurs during our own lifetime, we remember in pictures. The Secret Service man sprawled in the trunk of the presidential car in Dallas. That terrified child running down the road in Vietnam, bloodstains in the snow of Yugoslavia, or smoke pouring from the two towers. Much as those images stick in our minds and seem almost to belong to us, they're actually put there by somebody else. The children in a Sarajevo morgue still wearing snowsuits, the emaciated prisoners of war in Bosnia. These are pictures gathered by photojournalists, edited by someone else, printed on magazine covers, and only then etched in our mind as something emblematic of a time or an event. President Bush says the war in Iraq is over, others say it's still underway, but either way, the images of America's attack there are still something of a jumbled pile, not yet sorted into our mental album of the event. Today we talk with two of America's most highly regarded photojournalists about what they saw and the pictures we didn't see from Iraq. Connection listeners, what is it that the pictures mean to you? Do they record an event, or can they do more? Can they change the way we look at the world or at ourselves? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, I should remind you also that our website, theconnection.org, has a gallery of images by our two guests, pictures from before this war and images from Iraq. And I encourage you to take a look at that, if not now, especially if you're driving, then make a note. Do it later. Joining us today are two award-winning photographers, Ron Haviv and Christopher Morris. Ron's a contract photographer for Newsweek magazine, founding member of the photographer-owned Seven photo agency based in Paris. He's covered conflict in Latin America, the Caribbean, Africa, the Persian Gulf, Russia, and the Balkans. His latest book of photography is called Afghanistan on the Road to Kabul. And Christopher Morris is also with us. He's a contract photographer for Time magazine, another founding member of the Seven photo agency. And he's been documenting conflicts for nearly 20 years. Colombia, Afghanistan, Panama, Chechnya, the Persian Gulf, and Yugoslavia. Both men have recently returned from the war in Iraq, and they're with us this morning. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
Good morning, everybody.
I want you guys to tell me what you think at this point the image of the war in Iraq is or will be, what you'll remember, what we'll all remember. Chris, do you have one stuck in your head at this point?
It's hard for me. For me, the symbolic images for me are just U.S. troops when they were first in the presidential palaces. Early on when the war began, somebody asked me, what image would I want to have? And that was the image in my mind that I wanted. I wanted, you know, U.S. troops in one of Saddam's palaces. So those are the images that seem to stick with me most.
We actually have one in the gallery of a young Marine sitting in this unbelievably gaudy golden-leafed chair with flowers all around him. Tell me about that picture.
That is not sure of the day. I think it's the probably 10th. The 10th or the 11th. I'm not sure. But it was in one of the banquet halls to one of the main southern presidential palaces in Baghdad. And this one, he's not a Marine. He's with the 3rd ID Army. And he's actually trying to figure out, he was trying to figure out how he was going to get this chair out of the banquet hall to try to get it back to the States. His plan was to try to put it on eBay, actually. I don't know. I know he succeeded in getting the chair out of the building and into the front grass of the palace and into a vehicle, but I'm not sure if he ever got it back to the States.
Well, I tell you, people can take a look at that chair on our website, and if you see it there, you'll never forget it. Ron, what's the image either for you or that you think that we'll all remember?
Yeah, I don't think that there really is one image from this conflict, because it really was such a big story on so many different levels. There was the story about the Americans, there was a story about the Iraqis, there was the political aspects of what the administration was doing. And I think that I found it very difficult to try and illustrate that in one single image. I think it's just a little bit too complex to be able to do that.
One of the things that you chose to do this time around, Ron, was go in with the American soldiers, because when I look at collections of your work, and Chris, your work as well, it's invariably the strongest pieces are those who are the victims of conflict, the civilians, the people who were caught up in it. And yet you chose to go with the soldiers rather than with the civilians. Ron, why did you do that?
Well, I think it's primarily because this story really was about America and about the American soldiers being a representative of the American policy. It, as we all saw in all the diplomatic back and forth, as the arguments grew, it became less and less about Iraq and more about the way that the world order would work and what President Bush wanted to do. And it was important then to be able to have access to the American soldiers as symbols of the administration's what they wanted to do.
One of the photos of yours we have on our website is, I think they're two Humvees with very large cannons on the top and a helicopter kind of almost perfectly framed between them. Was that on your way into Baghdad when you took that picture?
That image happened about probably 4 or 5 hours after we crossed the border from Kuwait and we started to engage the Iraqis near the town of Basra. Mm-hmm. And these were the First Marine Division, the tank scouts who were going ahead to basically check out the Iraqi positions and see where they were, and then they report back to the tanks so they could make their targets, and they engaged some Iraqi tanks at that point.
Now, Chris, you weren't officially embedded as a photographer, but you went in with the 3rd Infantry Division, right?
Correct.
What about your decision there to travel with the troops? Same sort of rationale as Ronnie?
Yeah, it's the same thing. The international scene had changed. Like Ron had said, it had shifted from being about Iraq and more about what the U.S. was about to do. So you needed pictures of U.S. troops. And the only way to get that is if you're in somewhat embedded with them. It's very difficult just to drive up the road and show up with units that are advancing on a city and just try to merge in with them. So in a way, you needed to be embedded if you were going to have access to U.S. troops. So that was my decision to try to be embedded or at least get with a unit that was going to let me travel with them.
Was that weird for you to be with soldiers like that?
It wasn't really weird. The only problem with when you're embedded like that is you're very dependent on the units you're with. You're in a vehicle. It's very difficult if something happens a mile or even a half a mile up the road. You cannot physically get to that because the unit you're with maybe is not tasked for that mission. The town, there could be, you know, heavy firefight in a town nearby, and you can't get to it because of the unit you're with. Where if you're just on your own and you're working unilaterally and you have your own vehicle, you can at least maneuver through, you know, to try to reach those areas. But this was a difficult one. It was a difficult one logistically. And that was my choice. And I think most of the photographers that I worked with, they decided to try to do the embed.
Ron, I'm wondering if you were at all struck, I was, when I was in Baghdad, about just how young the soldiers are. I mean, you've been lots of nasty places. You probably had more experience in combat than most of the people you were riding with.
It's true. Every time that I've covered the U.S. forces in combat over the last 15 years or so, I'm always struck again about how young they are. This is a war conducted primarily by 18 and 19-year-old soldiers and Marines who are taking the majority of their orders from officers who are maybe 25 to 27. And continuously, I often have much more experience in combat than they do, including the officers. I'm sure the same was with Chris. Mm-hmm. There was maybe only one or two veterans from the Gulf War, certainly nobody from any previous conflict that was on the ground there. And it made for sometimes a very nerve-wracking situation for myself, because I could see at times when people would be getting into trouble or doing something wrong. And now that these guys are my protection, I need to also understand that the mistakes that they're making are going to affect me. And I've heard from other colleagues as well that we had to sometimes give some advice to some of the Marines and soldiers on perhaps you ought to like search that guy, or the checkpoint doesn't look very secure, and maybe you should do this, or try and calm some of the guys down during the fighting, because they were often very nervous in these situations, and we were always very worried about civilians being hit unnecessarily.
Did you also find, though, as Chris was explaining, that there was you had to give up some control? You didn't get to move around the way you would in Chechnya or in Yugoslavia.
Well, absolutely. As Chris was saying, this was an incredibly different way for us to work, and I was very nervous, at least definitely for the first week or so, where my movements and my safety and the decisions about where and what I was doing was being made by somebody else, and somebody else that had very little experience in these type of situations. I'm used to being able to make a decision. If I'm in a battle, should I go forward with these soldiers because I think there'll be a good photograph and it'll be safe, or maybe I don't think it's worth the risk and I stay behind? Here, there was really no option. When they moved, you moved.
And yet, when I do look at a collection of photographs from both of you, I have to tell you, from a personal perspective, it ends up being the ones of the Iraqis rather than the soldiers, which I find the more powerful. Chris, you've got a picture of a kid who can't be more than 10 years old, his hands up in a sandstorm, which...
I think he's actually quite younger than... I think he's younger than 10, yes. It's probably around 7. The thing that struck me most about the soldiers that I was with is definitely the age, but the fact that the U.S. spends all these resources to train them how to fight, but they do not train them at all at how to deal with... the people they're going to encounter on the battlefield. They don't train them at all how to handle civilians. Some of our casualties happened at checkpoints because vehicles drove up to the checkpoint and detonated a bomb. And the first time we had encountered Iraqi civilians, they had set up a checkpoint on the road, and they were very nervous, but they let these vehicles drive right up to them, and then they pull the people out of the vehicle and put them down on the ground and scream at them and search them and all that. But it's like, and I'm like standing back, why are they letting this vehicle drive up to them? They need to stop that vehicle 100 meters, 100 yards up the road, make the people dismount and get out. And anywhere in the world that you travel, you see that in Chechnya, in Israel. You don't let the vehicle, mm-hmm. because that could be the bomb delivery device, approach you. And what struck me was that there was no training on how to deal with civilians, on how to search them, how to talk to them. There were no translators. They didn't know that these orange and white vehicles were taxi. They thought they were army vehicles. And as a photographer with some experience, you have to sit there and you're explaining to these guys, hey, you shouldn't do it this way and that way. And at first, you know, the first day I didn't say anything because it's not my place as a photographer to tell them, you know, to advise them. That's not what my role is. But like Ron said, after several days, they start coming to you and asking you questions.
Connection listeners, we're talking about combat photography this hour with two of America's top photojournalists, Ron Haviv and Christopher Morris. Can photographs change the way we see the world or ourselves? And do photographs from the war zone capture something that words can't? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll talk a little bit more with Ron and Chris when we come back about time that they spent away from the troops once they were in Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR Boston.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. A chance for us all to talk about the pictures that are stuck in our heads from the conflict in Iraq, and question for you listeners whether or not those photographs can be or are more powerful than words. And what about the objectivity of them? That's something that we'll get to with our two guests. Christopher Morris is a contract photographer for Time magazine. His photographs have earned him a mantle full of awards, including the Robert Capa Gold Medal Award from the Overseas Press Club. Ron Haviv's also with us. He shoots for Newsweek magazine, and he's earned a number of World Press, Picture of the Year, Overseas Press Club awards for the work that they've done. Both of them have spent a lot of time in war zones with their cameras. 1-800-423-8255. Ron, there's an image that we have on our website I wanted to ask you about. It's just a collection of ropes lying in the dirt
Obviously, you took this after you left the Marines. Can you tell me what the picture's about?
Well, this particular picture is from a prison known as Abu Ghraib, which was one of the more infamous prisons for political and criminal people convicted under the Saddam regime. And as Baghdad started to become under control of the Americans, sort of this veneer, the protective veneer that existed over all the atrocities that the Iraqis had committed under Saddam's rule started to fade away, and all of a sudden we were starting to be able to go to places where no journalists had ever been allowed to before, and one of the places was this prison. And the prison had been looted, and most of the prisoners had been freed in the October amnesty, but a few that were kept during the war were found executed on the grounds of the prison. And as we sort of made our way around, we came to this room known as the gallows room, where they would hang prisoners twice a day, and a sort of very austere metallic room with these ropes with a little bit of padding around them, where they would hang the prisoners.
And I wanted you to describe it rather than me, because I wanted to say that I found the photograph quite powerful because the rope is in places taped up, obviously in a sort of a handhold or something. And I'm curious to know, when you're in the field, when you make a choice of, I've got to have a person in this picture or I don't want a person in this picture, that maybe the coils of rope on the ground can tell more of the story. Do you just blast away at everything and then look at it in your hotel room at night, or do you know at the time that you've got something?
Well, I hope I'm making more of a editing and composing idea while I'm working, and not just sort of blasting away. I mean, for that image of these ropes on the ground, there was really no need to have anybody in the photograph. We all recognize ropes and hangman's ropes, and to see that sort of, for me, a chilling scene of these ropes sort of coiled on the ground like snakes was quite terrifying.
And Chris, in the collection of photographs of yours that we have, there are a couple, and I think you were talking with one of our producers here about pictures that just weren't going to be run. Pictures that weren't ever going to make a front page or even, you know, be printed in Time. Who makes that call? I mean, obviously.
Well, go ahead. To be honest with you, I think the public makes that call. There's pictures that I have, over my career, I've noticed that there are pictures that the American public does not want to see. And the editors are aware of that. And sometimes that they'll push that boundary and they'll publish some photos. But especially now, the mood of the country since September 11th is everybody's kind of towing this general patriotic line. And there's an image, I think the image you're talking about, or at least the one that I've been trying to get published, it shows it was a civilian that was killed, and the Americans are dragging him down the street, basically to put him in a ditch and bury him in this ditch. They collected maybe 10 different bodies that they had killed, and just to bury him. And they're burying him not to hide them; it's just for health reasons. And
each one has an ankle of the civilian, right?
Dragging him face down to the street, and there's a Bradley vehicle coming by, flying a little American flag. And to me that was very symbolic. And nobody in this country seems to want to publish that picture, even though that was a big part of the story. In the war, a lot of innocent people do get killed. But I understand that's what warfare is about, and that happens.
But both of
you. I'm not
trying
to make a political statement by saying that the killing of, you know, civilians, it happens, basically.
But isn't it just an aversion to unpleasantness, that whether or not we're looking at the body of a dead Iraqi civilian or a dead American soldier, people don't want to turn or open their Time or their Newsweek necessarily and see corpses.
But the American public needs to realize that when a war occurs, people die, and they die on all sides, and sometimes people that are not involved in the war, innocent people, are killed. And as Americans, as people who vote and help make decisions help elect people who make these decisions, we need to understand that and take responsibility for it.
And is that part of your job?
Absolutely. Well, our job is to document and to make sure that everybody sees what's going on. The public makes their decisions on their own. It's not up to us to influence one way or the other. But I would hope by the knowledge of seeing this work, people can make a valid decision on their own. The American public is smart enough to be able to do that.
Chris, you were going to say something.
People have to understand that the consequences of wanting to rush into something, they need to know what they're about to do. They need to know that, even Iraqi soldiers, they have families. People are going to die. American soldiers are going to die for this bit of rush to war. It's just something to put a perspective on what they're rushing for. It's not very clean and sanitized. Even in the first Gulf War, it wasn't clean and sanitized. People die, and they die in very horrific ways. And occasionally, people have to be reminded of that. Early on in this war, I was probably opposed to the fact that what we were going to doing, at least over this, the weapons of mass destructions. But after being in Iraq and seeing it and seeing how the people were received once they reached to Baghdad and that they were liberated from a tyrant, that it probably was a good thing, at least justified in the sense that they removed the tyrant, not justified in the sense of weapons of mass destruction.
You know this stuff better than I do, Chris, but I'm wondering whether or not that change of heart had to do with the fact that you traveled in with the soldiers rather than, stood at the southern edge of Baghdad with the Iraqi soldiers watching the onslaught come towards them.
No, because I think even the first 2 weeks, maybe first 10 days, we weren't received very well. And the civilian deaths. I just think that overall, when the horrors that you start to hear about Saddam's regime that are proven, the things around Najaf, the putting down of the Shiites and the Kurds, that it just puts it into a different perspective. And I just wish that the administration had focused on that more, then maybe they would have had more support than putting all their eggs on weapons of mass destruction.
Let's take our first call now. Kathy's on the line in Boston. Kathy, hi.
Hi, I'm very interested in this topic. In the 60s, I worked for Life magazine, and my assignment was in those days, Life publications answered all the letters to the editor, and my assignment was to answer letters regarding the covers of Life, and over its history, Life magazine ran some of the most impressive and disturbing photographs. And the one that seemed...
Kathy, were these answers that were published in the magazine or just answers that you wrote back?
No, we wrote back to subscribers and readers.
Right, gotcha. Go ahead.
The one that gave us the most difficulty was the one involving the inner city riots in Newark, in which the cover was a 14-year-old boy lying in the gutter bleeding to death from the shot of a police officer. The first time, I think, and I was a college kid, but I think it was the first time that I was aware of a photograph, in fact, changing the attitude of the public at large toward a problem, which was civil rights and civil disobedience, and that the riots in some way were incited by the police activity and the firing of the police.
Did the editors of the magazine have to take a risk to put that photo on the cover, Kathy?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, we were told that the photograph went all the way up to Hedley Donovan, who was then the publisher, who made the final decision to run that photograph. And he used as an example the famous, very famous black and white photograph of the Algerian soldier being shot, being killed, which ran on the in the covers of that magazine during the 50s, as proof that this is how we educate the American public, which is what publications are there to do.
Chris, in Yugoslavia, you spent some time in the morgue after a bunch of kids were killed playing outside in the winter, and there are a collection of photographs of children in the morgue wearing their snowsuits. And I'm listening to Kathy describe that. I'm thinking, in a way, that that collection of images has something of that same power.
Yes, I know. Time magazine at the time did run. They ran a photo. You don't have it there. It's a picture of their sleigh in the snow with the bloodstained snow. But it was a breaking point for me in the war in terms of I just couldn't. I basically lost it. I couldn't stand to see the slaughter that was going on year after year in Bosnia without any kind of world reaction. I remember Clinton. That very day, I listened on the BBC from the night before. He was asked in a press conference what was he going to do about the humanitarian crisis in Sarajevo. And he basically came back and said there was no humanitarian crisis in Sarajevo, that the people had food. And after hearing that and seeing these children, some of them having their faces removed by shrapnel, it struck me that what is a humanitarian crisis? The family that these children are from, trust me, they're not worried about where they're going to eat the next day. They just lost their family. And it really shook me. It shook me to the core of my basically existence, where I did not even want to really even cover it anymore, because I felt that photography at that point, we weren't making a change. And just the inaction by the government back then. That's also why what happened in Iraq, in the sense how it changed me going in there and seeing that what we did do there now, it is helpful. That when there are tyrants, that sometimes you have to go in there and rid them of that. I just wish we had done that in Yugoslavia early on. We could have stopped a lot of bloodshed.
Ron, I know you've made the same observation or had the same frustration of wondering whether the pictures were ever going to make a difference in the former Yugoslavia.
Yes, but I've come as I've sort of, as time has gone on, as a photographer, I've come to the realization that photography can play several different roles. I think initially when Chris and myself and our colleagues go to these places, the immediate mission is to tell the world what's happening in an attempt to have a reaction by the governments and by the public. But quite often that fails. And when that does fail, the photography then begins to take on a different life. It becomes evidence. They become documents of what was happening at a place such as Yugoslavia. And then when the war is over or many years later, when people sort of go back and start to rewrite history, they can never say, well, we didn't know. Well, they did know, because people like Chris and myself were there producing these photographs. And the work stands there as accusations to those who did nothing when they had the opportunity.
It becomes more of a historical record. For at least that's the way I've started to look at it. It's not so much to affect the public now, because I'm finding it's very difficult to do. I just want to make sure, as a historical record, that it helps set the facts straight.
I mean, for example, with the rioting and looting that took place in Baghdad after the Americans arrived, and Donald Rumsfeld went and said, "Oh well, the TV is just showing the same guy over and over again." Well, it's not true. I mean, the looting was widespread all over the city, and there were photographers and camera people and reporters right. documenting this. And that's going to hold the American administration responsible for post-war Iraq. I mean, I think that it's very dangerous when politicians can just sort of say, oh, the images are not true, or you're not paying attention to the American public, when people are doing this work and the images do exist to prove them wrong.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Kathy, thanks for your call. Next to Allentown, Pennsylvania, Lou's joining us. Hi, Lou.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I think photographs of a war can still be parallel to sound bites, with the exception of what the gentleman just said. After a period of time, they can be viewed as a historical document where more commentary can be on them. But I think initially nobody nobody knows what went before or went after a particular photograph is taken. Even the videos, I think, as the other gentleman was speaking of, where they were just replaying the one over and over again. But Lou,
you can't argue with a picture of a corpse lying in the grass.
No, you can't. But we already know that this would happen. All it does, I think, is inflame those people who said, well, this should have never happened. Why did we go in there after, you know, why did we go in there or rush to war, like the one gentleman said? And I think everybody knew that it wouldn't be a perfect, clean war. I don't know of anyone that would know that there would be corpses around.
Yeah, but I don't see
any real particular point to just shooting a picture of a corpse or a child.
Okay, Lou, hang on a second. I want to let Chris in here.
Lou, the thing is, if we don't try to document that, it becomes a very sanitized thing that people will say that it didn't happen or it doesn't exist. And that's the importance for us to photograph the things that we see. I would say, you know, 90% of the stuff we photograph doesn't even get published, but it is a historical record that we have. It is an archive, and we do photograph it.
Is he right, though, Ron, to say that it's like a sound bite, that the image doesn't give you the whole battlefield, but just a sort of postage stamp size picture?
Well, by the very nature of photography, you're seeing our vision in a very split, you know, 1/500th of a second of our view of what's happening, added with the captions. So I think that the American public needs to take that into respect with all the other news that they're getting, that photography plays a role in the process of understanding what's happening.
All right. Lou, thanks for that call. Connection listeners, we are talking about the power of photographs from the war zone this hour. Are they more powerful than words, than a soundbite, more objective? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, looking at the rift between the U.S. and France.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. With me today are two of the world's top photojournalists, Ron Haviv, contract photographer for Newsweek magazine, Chris Morris from Time. And we're talking about the power of photography from the war zone. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And a reminder, you can see a photo gallery of photographs both Ron and Chris have taken before the war in Iraq and more from their respective trips into Baghdad on our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. Ron, help me with this notion of, is it objective or is it, you know, a form of advocacy when you're choosing and composing and urging an editor to run a shot? Because what I'm hearing you describe is kind of somewhere in between the two. Do you know what I mean?
I'm not sure exactly when you're talking about objective. I think there's always that misconception that photography is objective,
right,
when it's completely subjective. And since it's subjective, it is the photographer's viewpoint, my viewpoint of what I'm seeing and what I want to illustrate and how I want to tell the story. And that goes from taking the photograph to when it's being transmitted to New York and when the editors receive the photographs, and then they're making their own interpretation on how they're reporting the story, and then it finally reaches the public. So it goes through several layers of interpretation. The only thing that the audience should expect is that the photograph is fair, that it's truthful, that I'm not misrepresenting a situation, that what you're seeing is actually indicative of what's occurring in front of me.
Do we still see that, Chris? People, photojournalists composing a shot, putting something together?
No, absolutely. In the sense of artistically, you're trying to... art in the sense... Go ahead, explain that.
Sorry, you had mentioned earlier to one of the producers that that a couple of shooters that you saw in Kuwait were composing.
That's more of staging, not composing.
So,
composing
I'm sorry,
is more visual. I thought you meant visually composing the picture. No, there's The problem is with we have to keep ourselves in our industry, especially the photojournalists. We're not really regulated by anybody. And morally, we have to keep our standards very, very high. And whenever I see other photographers doing something that I feel jeopardizes our industry, mainly staging of photos or recreating photos, I try to put a stop to it immediately by confronting them.
What did you see in Kuwait? What happened there?
Well, early on during the training of Kuwait, there were actually two British photographers, and they were actually recreating a scene, posing somebody and moving them, and I confronted them on that, and they basically said, that's normal, we do that all the time, our readers expect it from us. And I took real issue with that. Because, you know, it puts into question everything we do. And it's very important that the photographers that are working keep high standards.
1-800.
I wouldn't say it happens often, but it does happen.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go back to the lines. Apex, North Carolina. Rodney's joining us. Hi, Rodney.
How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you for having me on. My comment was basically kind of in reference to what the last caller had said. I'm a college student about to get into history education, high school, and I've had an opportunity to be inside the classroom and teach. And our generation is a very visual generation. We thrive on images, and to see these images and to see the reality that they bring to the table for these students is absolutely essential. I applaud both of you for going in there where our eyes can't be and bringing those images to life for these students, because they have no idea what's going on. Their world exists in MTV, BET, and what they can see immediately, and if they're not seeing these real images, then they're bombarded with fantastical images of The Bachelor, all these real-life shows that don't show the reality of war.
And, Rodney, do you find that the still photograph can contribute something that the evening video on the television news cannot?
I think in the fact that it allows the person to evoke whatever sentiments that are inside them, it awakens their spirit so that they, because our students don't actually often think for themselves, they're thought for. Like if you're watching a newscast, they're interpreting those images for you. When you see a still image, you're left for your own interpretation. You don't know what's going on to the left or to the right. You see exactly what you see, and you're left to bring some sort of meaning to that image, and it comes from inside you.
Very well spoken, Rodney. Very well spoken.
Thank you.
Ron.
I applaud both of you gentlemen for actually doing it. I know I wouldn't have the courage to go in there, and I'm glad that you represent my eyes and you can see why I can be able to see what you see.
Thank you.
I want to just pick up I applaud you both as well, because I know, working as a radio reporter in places like that, I don't actually have to go up to the front line. I just, you know, get to record the bang-bang from a nice, safe place, and that's not an option that either of you have. But do you develop an appetite for that type of work, or do you develop a distaste for it? Ron?
Well, I think it's definitely a distaste for it in that I always regret seeing. We keep going back. I mean, primarily because if you look at human history, this is countries are usually formed or die in conflict. The history of humanity usually occurs in conflict, and it's incredibly important for somebody to be there to document it. So until war stops, then people like myself will keep going back in the hope that people will look at the images and the next generation will learn, and hopefully when they become able to make political decisions and whether to send armies into battle, they'll look for something else. But I think it's each one of us hopes that we don't have to cover another war, but unfortunately we keep going back.
Chris, what about you?
With still photography, I don't think the public realizes with a photographer you have to get quite close, even much closer than a TV camera. You basically, if you're not within 20 feet of what something's happened, it really does not make a good photograph. Writers can come back later and they can interview witnesses to the act and make a good story out of it. TV can film from a rooftop of a hotel of a battle that's happening a half a mile away, and they got audio and they can make something out of it. But for a good still photographer, you have to be still photograph. You have to be right there. And early on in my career, that's what excited me about it. And it still does today, the fact that you're witnessing history from very close. It's almost like if you were covering a football game, you're actually almost in the football game.
There must be, though, something of a selfish side to wanting to be there, to going back for that historical thrill or combat buzz.
Well, if you have loved ones and you have a family, then it is a very selfish profession. And I've come to realize that over the years, now that I have two children, and I've been slowly over the last 3-4 years been trying to back out of it and do other things with my photography. It's just the way the world keeps shifting and moving, these stories seem to get bigger and bigger, almost more apocalyptic as it goes on, so it's harder to stay away from those, even with the family. But it is a very selfish profession in that sense.
But it's an absolute privilege to be able to be there, to be able to witness for yourself what's happening, how the world is changing right before your eyes, and then to be able to send your interpretation of that event to the world. I mean, it's an incredible opportunity to do that. So it, as a selfish motive, absolutely. It's completely selfish in that regard.
This agency that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Seven, that you're both founding members of, this is not just a commercial, gamma type thing. This is something that's photographer owned. Is there a part of what we're talking about now which is behind the behind Seven, the agency?
Well, the agency was formed in response to what's occurring in the photographic industry of a corporate takeover by Bill Gates and Mark Getty, who are buying up all the smaller photo agencies in an attempt to control the image, who has control of the image for the future. And
as an artist or as a storyteller?
Historically, as control artists.
They want to own the content. Right. So when people need photographs, they'll go to Getty or they'll go to Corbis. But the people that suffer to some degree in their independence are the photographers. And as such, Chris, myself, and five other photographers formed Seven as a co-op in order to take more responsibility for our work, where the work is published, what happens to it, the historical archive, and not to have to sort of bend or change anything due to any sort of corporate rulings.
And that means that as photographers, you get to decide what happens with your pictures. If we here at The Connection want to do a program on it and say, can you send us some pictures? You don't have to get approval. These are yours. You can send them. Say, yeah. Is that the difference?
Exactly. We make the decisions. It's not a salesperson. It's not a number of different researchers. The images are under our control, so we can make sure that the images are being used correctly, that the information that's being presented to the audience is correct, and just really understand what's happening with our work, because the work that we do, the type of stories that we cover, are politically sensitive, and we need to make sure that the people that are using it properly.
Chris, when we have, or if we have difficulty identifying an image of the war in Iraq so far, is that because the story is still only just partly told?
I think it's just because it's there's just so many pieces to the puzzle that it's hard to have that defining picture. Even from September 11th, there was one or two pictures that seemed to have stuck in people's mind. I don't think that has happened in Iraq. And time will tell. We'll see what is being produced. The story is continuing as we speak.
I mean, Ron, I'll open the paper as I did today and see a grieving father with a plastic bag full of bones that he's found in a mass grave somewhere in southern Iraq. And I mean, the text of the story is as chilling as the photo itself when they talk about the hundreds, maybe thousands of people who have yet to be exhumed from those graves.
Yeah, and I think that those images are going to, they continued from the first week of Baghdad falling, and I think they're going to, unfortunately, continue for many months as these different pieces of evidence of the evil that occurred under Saddam's rule will come to light.
You actually have one of those photographs of Shiite family members digging up a shallow grave. Was that also taken at the Abu Ghraib prison?
It was taken at the cemetery for the Abu Ghraib prison, and it was quite amazing because it sort of unfolded after a few days. When the looting was occurring, a number of people went to the prison, and they took the records of the people that had been executed, because the grave sites were only by number, and nobody knew the names. So now all of a sudden, the families could go and find the names and relate it to the number of the grave, and they started to, as the word spread, and it was very slow since there was no telephone service, and the information was spread through the mosque, that every day more and more families would start to show up, and they would start to exhume their relatives. And it was an incredibly emotional scene where people weren't sure if their families had been killed, so now they have this little scrap of paper with their father or their brother or their son's name on it, and just that realization was overwhelming. And then to dig up the bodies was quite an extraordinary scene to witness.
Connection listeners, a reminder, the photographs of Ron Haviv and Christopher Morris are on our website at theconnection.org. And special thanks to both of you for spending an hour with us today. Ron, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ron Haviv is a contract photographer for Newsweek magazine. Christopher, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Chris is a contract photographer for Time. Both are also featured in a new book, Shooting Under Fire, The World of the War Photographer, by Peter Howe. There'll be a link to that on our website as well. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR, here and now with Bill Delaney and Robin Young is coming up next at noon. We're funded by UR listeners, also by Brigham's Ice Cream, introducing the new Brigham's Ice Cream Bars, a stickless bar of Brigham's vanilla ice cream covered in milk or dark chocolate, available at most supermarkets.